Members, I will now call the Post-Secondary Education and Lifelong Learning Subcommittee to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Mariano?
Here.
Vice Chair Mello?
Here.
Ranking Member Alexander?
Here.
Representative Andrade?
Here.
Representative Arrington?
Here.
Representative Bell?
Here.
Representative Botana?
Here.
Representative Caruso?
Good morning.
Representative Fernandez-Barkin? Representative Gottlieb?
Here.
Representative Harding?
Here.
Representative Mooney?
Here.
Representative Morales?
Present.
Representative Persons Malika?
Here.
Representative Placencia? Representative Salzman?
Here.
Representative Tant?
Here.
Representative Williams?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Missy, and by your presence, we have a quorum. Everyone, please turn off or silence your cell phones at this time. And anyone wishing to speak today during the meeting, please complete an appearance card and give it to one of our staff members. Good morning, everyone. Looking forward to a productive meeting today. We have three presentations coming up on our nursing programs in our state. Looking forward to that, as well as two bills. First, I am going to actually pass over the gavel to Vice Chair Mello so I can introduce the PCB.
We will now take up PCB 2201 relating to post-secondary education. Chair Mariano, you are recognized to explain the PCB.
Thank you. Good morning, members. This bill contains measures that will assist in post-secondary education affordability, provide informed consumer choice to our students as they pursue higher education, improve the articulation process, and foster innovation among our institutions by allowing our institutions to choose an accreditor. The bill subjects any Florida college system institution or state university proposal or action to increase a fee to a supermajority vote. The bill requires each Florida college system institution and state university to prominently post all tuition and fees, as well as any proposed changes to their respective websites in an area that is transparent and easily accessible, and email to all enrolled students. In addition, any proposed changes to a fee must include an explanation of how they are currently expended. Current law requires lists of recommended textbooks and instructional materials to be posted at least 45 days before the first day of class for each term. This bill also requires the posting of course syllabi for general education courses be posted 45 days before the first day of class. In addition, the bill requires these materials be posted for at least 5 academic years, be searchable by the course subject, course number, course title, name of the instructor of the course, and the title and the author of each book, be easily downloadable by current and prospective students. Adding the syllabi as a requirement for general education classes is a huge step forward for our students. From personal experience, recommended textbooks are often not utilized in the course, and the syllabus is where students can actually see what materials are needed for a course and ensures they do not purchase textbooks that are not necessary for the course. Requires post-secondary institutions participating in the statewide course numbering system to accept and apply general education courses and credit as first satisfying general education core course requirements and other general education subject area course credit requirements before applying the course credit as elective credit. As it relates to accreditation, this bill prohibits a state college or state university from being accredited by the same accrediting agency or association for consecutive accreditation cycles and requires state colleges and state universities to seek and obtain accreditation from an accrediting agency other than their current accrediting agency. This change is a result of the update to federal regulations. In 2020, the US DOE revised federal regulations to remove the traditional geographic boundaries of the accreditation process, allowing for institutions, if authorized by their state, to pursue the accreditor of their choice. Different accrediting agencies focus on different metrics when accrediting institutions, and this bill will allow our institutions to pursue accreditors that prioritize student outcomes, as we do here in Florida. In order to protect our institutions, this bill also provides a cause of action against an accrediting agency or association by a post-secondary education institution that has been negatively impacted by the retaliatory action taken against the post-secondary education institution by an accrediting agency or association. That is the bill.
Members, are there any questions on the PCB? Yes, Representative Alexander, I apologize. Ranking Member Alexander, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Mara, thank you for bringing the PCB forward. And there are a lot of good things in the PCB. I do have questions in regards to the accreditation process on how that works. Can you speak to how a consecutive accreditation cycle is defined?
Chair Mariano, you're recognized.
Thank you. So accreditation process, they usually have a 5-year reaffirmation period and then a 10-year total span. So this bill is once they've hit their 10-year total span, then they seek a new accreditor.
Ranking Member Alexander, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just get some more clarification. I know typically state universities and state colleges, they will have potential findings from their accrediting body. And so what would be the impetus for institutions to abide by those findings to improve their standings if they are constantly going into another system?
Chair Mariano, you're recognized.
Thank you. I'm not sure if I fully understand your question, but what this bill would do is it allows the institution to pick the accrediting agency that best suits their goals in terms of student outcomes. There's been different studies done that demonstrate which accrediting agencies prioritize student outcomes. And so this bill will allow them to make sure their accrediting agency are looking at and studying what is important to their institution, and that falls in line with our recommendations here in Florida.
Okay, follow up, Ranking Member Alexander.
Thank you, and I'll share everything else for debate. So does the language allow or does it require state universities and colleges to change their accrediting body?
Chair Mariano, you're recognized.
Thank you. The bill requires that they rotate accreditation bodies.
Okay, any other questions, members? Okay, Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you. How many accrediting bodies are there?
Chair Mariano, you're recognized.
There's about 6 or 7 big ones that are at the same level in size and scope as our current accreditor.
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
And are they all currently recognized and being utilized in Florida?
Chair Mariano, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. They are not being utilized in Florida because, as I mentioned in my opening, there was previously federal regulation that prohibited universities and colleges from going outside of their region. Now that that has been rolled back, we want to make sure that we are giving our institutions all of the options on the table to be able to find the accreditor that is best suited for their institution.
Representative Tant, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Madam Chair. A quick question. In regards to the accrediting agencies, my concern is, like, you know, Florida State University and University of Florida are Carnegie One research institutions. Those accreditations are probably different or more complex or more involved than accrediting some of our other colleges and universities. And so my concern is that if the 6 or 7 accrediting entities aren't yet in Florida, or we're going to need to do this, how do we know that the accreditation is going to be a good accreditation for those schools, that it's going to be a legitimate and trustworthy accreditation for those very complex universities?
Chair Mariano, you are recognized.
Thank you. It's a great question. There are many other prestigious universities that are accredited by other accrediting agencies. This actually, to your point, gives them more options because right now they are locked in to one accreditor. Now they're going to have 6 or 7 great options to choose from, and they can pick which ones go best with what their priorities are, and those institutions, as you mentioned, research institutions will be able to, with their experts on their teams, be able to decipher which one is going to be the best fit for them and for their students.
Follow-up.
Representative Tant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In respect to the accreditation, I don't know how long accreditations actually take and what they cost. Do you happen to have that information?
Chair Mariano, you are recognized.
Thank you. So it varies based on the accrediting agency, but from the research we've done, thousands of dollars, looks like under $100,000. $100,000 would be high.
Members, seeing no further questions, we will move into public testimony. We have one appearance card, and that is David Armstrong, who's the president of St. Thomas University, wishing to speak.
Good morning, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm going to have a rare occurrence here. I am not here to ask for anything. I'm here to say thank you. To give an example, when we talk about the healthcare gap analysis updates, St. Thomas University 5 years ago started the nursing program. We had 13 nurses. 3 years ago, the state gave us $1 million appropriation for our nursing program. We now have almost 900 nursing students at St. Thomas University. We believe we can grow that to 2,000. And I just want to thank the state for the support. That was led by State Senator Manny Diaz and at the time, House Representative Ana Maria Rodriguez. And your support, the state support for nursing education to handle that gap that we have really matters. So thank you.
Thank you, David Armstrong from St. Thomas University. I don't believe we have any more appearance cards. Members, we will move into debate. Members, is there any that wish to debate the PCB? Ranking Member Alexander, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I think extremely highly of Chair Mariano, and she has a true spirit for moving our state colleges and state universities forward. And she and I share similar perspectives on a wide range of issues. She is very close to the issues that impact students every single day. And so her knowledge base is very important to me. In particular to the accreditation part, the part that gives me pause is the require part. I believe that if it was allowable based off a certain framework, giving the state universities or colleges to give a justification to their larger board to do so, i.e. the Board of Governors, i.e. the State Board of Education, based off some discrepancies, I would be open to it. But I do feel it is a poison pill to the PCB. When I look at the critical aspect of being accredited, being eligible for federal funds, when you look at the exhaustive nature and the overall internal apparatuses that align towards getting institutions accredited, it is an ongoing process. One of the things that is coming to mind is that as entities began to come in to offer their ability to offer accrediting services to our institutions, I really feel like on both sides there could be gaming of the system. I think that having continuity through SACs and having apples being compared to apples and oranges being compared to oranges gives that continuity. Along with that, many of the strategic long-term objectives that are outlined in regards to findings take 3 or 4 or 5 years to vertically integrate appropriate resources towards addressing those issues. And so what I also see is a significant amount of volatility and not being able to really put the resources and the time to actually make corrections, sustain those corrections, and be able to evaluate those corrections to move that particular finding forward. And so I would be open to voting for this under a structure that gave the Board of Governors and the Board of Education some insight if there were some specific dynamics to justify doing that, but requiring it over allowing it, it's a tough pill for me to swallow. And so I will be against it today, but look forward to having further conversations with the chair. I know she's very open as this product moves forward, but I will say for the most part, job well done. But this is a significant piece that I think needs to be addressed and further looked at and to bring our stakeholders in to give their insights as well.
Thank you, Ranking Member Alexander. Representative Andrade.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to provide a respectful counterbalance to that perspective on the accreditation process and the fact that some of the most onerous words any government official can say are, it's how we've always done it. As we all know, complacency doesn't help. It actually inhibits and prohibits innovation. The ability to go compete, to go be forced to actually go and assess what your students are learning based on different but just as acceptable standards, I think gives an opportunity for universities to improve and challenge themselves as those cycles go forward. So I appreciate the concept that's being proposed, and I fully support the idea of essentially providing the impetus for our universities to innovate and grow and provide a better value to our students here in the state of Florida. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Andrade. Members, we are in debate. Are there any other members wishing to debate? Representative Tant, you are recognized.
Thank you. Along with what both of my colleagues here have said, thank you, Madam Chairs. I'm agnostic about the accrediting bodies. I just want to make sure that the accrediting bodies are going to be up to this task of doing this vital work, because student aid is at stake. And so I want to be part of the solution and working for this bill, but I can't do it today. But I definitely want to work with you, because I agree with both of the sentiments that have been expressed here. But I am concerned about getting that part right, because too much is at stake for the students of Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tant. Members, any further debate? Seeing none, Chair Mariano, you are recognized to close on the PCB.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. You know, there are a lot of very important provisions for our students in this bill regarding the publication of syllabi. I think that's very important as students are making their choices in their courses and making sure that the textbooks that they're being recommended or required to purchase are going to be utilized. So I think that's a huge thing that we're doing. And then, of course, the accreditation piece. I think it's very important that we give our institutions the ability to, as our systems of learning evolve with this, you know, the increase in technology, that they can pick the accreditor that is going to best suit their needs. You know, as I previously mentioned, there's a study in 2018 that breaks down these major accrediting agencies and shows what they put their focus on. And student outcomes is not the focus of all of the accrediting agencies. And I think that's important to know, that as we have our performance funding model based on student outcomes, we need to make sure that we are doing that across the board and that every institution has the ability to make sure that they are focused in every way on student outcomes. So I would really appreciate your support on this bill today, and my door is always open moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mariano. Chair Mariano, having closed, Missy, please call the roll and announce the vote.
Representatives Alexander?
No.
Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
No.
Bell?
Yes.
Batana?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Fernandez-Barquin?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Harding? Mooney?
Yes.
Morales?
No.
Persons-Malika?
Yes.
Plasencia?
Yes.
Salzman?
Yes.
Tant?
No.
Williams?
No.
Mariano?
Yes.
Chair Mello?
Yes.
11 yeas.
By your vote, PCB 2201 is reported favorably.
Thank you, Chair Mello. Next, we will take up House Bill 1407 by Representative Valdez relating to Hunger Free Campus Grant Program. You are recognized.
Good morning, Chair Mariano, Vice Chair Mello, and Ranking Member Alexander. Thank you so much for hearing House Bill 1407 this morning. This bill establishes the Hunger Free Campus Grant Program within the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. House Bill 1407 would designate qualified colleges and campuses as a hunger-free campuses and provide them the resources to help tackle hunger in our campuses. Currently, 1 in 3 students face food insecurity. Nearly 1/3 of college students have missed a meal at least once a week since the beginning of the pandemic. The bill requires that the Commissioner of Agriculture to designate a public post-secondary campuses meeting applicable eligibility requirements as hunger-free campuses. The bill establishes eligibility requirements for post-secondary institutions, including establishing a hunger task force, designating a staff member responsible for assisting students to enroll in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, better known as SNAP, and also providing options for students to use SNAP benefits at campuses' stores or providing students with information on where SNAP benefits may be used, providing at least one physical food pantry on campuses or providing a similar option, developing a student meal credit donation program or designating a certain amount of funds for free food vouchers, and annually conducting a student survey on hunger and submitting the results to the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. The bill authorizes the Commissioner of Agriculture to award grants on a competitive basis to institutions with one or more hunger-free campuses, subject to the appropriations of the funds by the legislator. The bill specifies prioritizing grants made to institutions with the highest percentages of eligible Pell Grant recipients. Additionally, the bill requires grant recipients to submit a report to the FDACS describing how grants awarded were used. The bill requires the Commissioner of Agriculture to submit a report on the Hunger-Free Campus Grant Program to the Governor, President of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives by July 1st of 2024. The report must include the number of and amounts of grants awarded and the impact of the program and recommendations regarding funding for the program. Madam Chair, this is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Valdez. Members, do we have any questions on the bill? Seeing none, we will move to public testimony. First, we have Andres Cabillos, looks like. Please correct me. You're welcome to come up to the podium.
Oh, well, good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of this amazing committee. My name is Andres Cubillos, and I am a second-year political science and international affairs student at Florida State University, and I am here to speak in favor of HB 1407, the Hunger-Free Campus Bill. The reality of so many students in our state is one that does not guarantee something as fundamental as a nutritional meal when you come home from your classes. This is a reality that Florida should not accept. The issue affects students across the state. In fact, an average of 40% of students at Miami-Dade College, Florida Atlantic University, and the University of South Florida experience some form of food insecurity. Total, that is around 75,000 students. This issue also affects students here in Tallahassee. In fact, at Florida State University and Tallahassee Community College, there is no data on food insecurity for its students. The struggles of students just outside of these doors is one that is not seen or even acknowledged. In fact, even at schools that do have food pantries and other tools to fight back food insecurity, they are severely lacking. At the University of West Florida, UWF, the pantry is only open on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. That makes it impossible for students who work full-time or have kids to visit the pantry. The grant program that is set forth in the Hunger-Free Campus Bill will help schools across the state tailor their programs to individually impact their students. The Hunger-Free Campus Bill will help our schools address the needs of their unseen students, and by passing the bill, hardworking students across the state will have the basic needs that they require to succeed in their academics and succeed in their careers. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak, and I would hope that you support the Hunger-Free Campus Bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and your advocacy. Next, we'll have Alexandra Langley. You're recognized. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Hello, representatives. What I'm here to speak about is that I'm actually also in favor of this bill that Andreas has just spoken to y'all about. And what I actually wanted to share is that I actually did come close to also experiencing food insecurity myself. I am an FSU student. When I was an undergrad at FSU, I was struggling. My student loans, my scholarships did not cover everything that I needed to even be able to pay off my tuition. I had to put off doing my books. I had to put off all kinds of things just so I would be able to afford first my tuition. My books I bought the next month. And if I had not been living with my parents at the time, I would have been food insecure. It would have been ended badly, and possibly I would have had to leave my schooling at that time. Currently now that I pay, of course, for, you know, everything by myself, of course I do experience some of that as well now. I sometimes do skip meals so that I don't have to worry about, you know, money for gas or money for other things that I might need will come first. Bills will always come first over food. And that is a reality that many students face. And I think that definitely y'all should vote yes on this bill, because there are other students who are like me who probably don't even know or don't even recognize or don't want to admit that they do experience this. So thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Seeing no other public testimony, we are now in debate. Any members wishing to debate the bill? Thank you, Member Alexander. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Mayor. I just want to publicly thank you for agendaing this awesome bill, and thank you for all your hard work in this bill. As a former student body president in the state university system, I've seen it all, and there's great meaning and value in this, and so this is a great bill. I want to thank you, Chair, for allowing this to be heard today, and I encourage all my colleagues to vote up on the bill.
Thank you. Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I want to start off by saying thank you very much for hearing this bill. And Representative Valdez, this is an excellent, excellent bill. When we have people that don't know where their next meal is coming from, we have students that's in school and struggling just to make ends meet, and us as state legislators are able to make these kind of bills put in place to keep them from not being able to have a meal is so important to us. And I want to say thank you to the young man, young lady that spoke. Thank you for having the courage to come up and speak to us and knowing how other students on campus struggle to make ends meet and have a meal on their table, letting us know that these things actually happen. I'm a product of, my daughter attended Florida State. And during the time she was there, she had three roommates. Two of the girls that was there with her didn't have parents that were able to help them. So we would create what we call a food box and send additional food box to these young ladies in order for them to be able to stay in school, because they did not have. So I want to say thank you again, Rep. Valdez, for putting this bill together. It was much needed for students that are struggling. Thank you.
Any other members in debate? Seeing none, Representative Valdez, you are recognized. Representative Tant, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this bill, and thank you to this committee for hearing it. Thank you to Chair Mariano for scheduling it. I am aware of some of the needs on our campuses here. I know that there are food pantries on all of the campuses in Tallahassee, and how critically they are and how useful they are and necessary. So thank you for coming today, and thank you for this bill, and thank you for doing the work, and I'm grateful for the committee's work on this. Thank you.
Any other members in debate? Seeing none, Representative Valdez, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair Plasencia, and I do appreciate all of the comments and to the students that came up and had the courage to share their perspectives and their story. I know that that's difficult. This is an opportunity to continue to take care of the most precious commodity we have in the state of Florida, and that's our children, and giving them the opportunities to flourish and prosper by offering not only a world-class education and ensuring that they do not go hungry while obtaining that education. Members, Chair Mariano, thank you very much for hearing this bill, and I do ask for your favorable support this morning. Thank you.
Representative Valdez, having closed on her bill, Missy, please call the roll and announce the vote.
Representatives Alexander?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Batana? Caruso? Fernandez-Barkin?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Harding?
Yes.
Mello? Mooney?
Yes.
Morales?
Yes.
Persons Malika?
Yes.
Salzman?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Mariano? Yes. Chair Plasencia?
Yes.
15 yes, 0 nays.
By your vote, HB 1407 is reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair Plasencia, and thank you, committee. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. And sorry, I just spoke for a second, but I just want to thank the students as well for your advocacy and all that you've done to help move this bill forward. So thank you. All right, next we are going to move on to our presentations. First, we're going to have Chancellor Kreiser come up for the Board of Governors to go over the nursing education programs at our state universities. Thank you so much.
Chair Mariano, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to appear before you today. The presentation I have is going to walk through some of the work that we have been doing in response to House Bill 1507, which was passed last year, and I'll explain a little bit more about the content and then go through the context and the work that our Board of Governors and the state university system are engaged in. Real quickly, the House Bill 1507 required our board to provide 10-year trend information on pre-licensure nursing education programs. I'll speak to each of the seven elements that were required in the bill as I go through the presentation, and happy to dig deeper if there's anything in particular that you're interested in. In first part, wanted to identify that we have 10 state universities who have nursing programs, 10 of our 12. The two that do not are New College and Florida Polytechnic. Nine of our 10 programs provide what would be viewed as a traditional nursing program, where someone would enter the program as a junior. And I guess I should make a point is that all of our nursing education is focused on a Bachelor's of Science in Nursing or higher degree, so a BSN or up into the graduate level degrees. Florida Atlantic University actually has created three novel approaches to nursing, and I'll actually have a chart after this that show which universities do which, but have looked at the elements for freshmen being admitted directly into the nursing program, working with individuals who already have a undergraduate degree and are pursuing a second degree and would like to go into nursing, as well as an accelerated second degree program. I'm going to go to my chart so I get it right, but the VCARE program is one where we're specifically working with veterans who have some kind of medical background. And so to break that down a little bit, this is where these programs appear at each of our universities. Seven of them now are involved in working with the idea of accelerated programs for someone seeking a second degree. Essentially, you would not have to repeat the 60 hours that are the core curriculum for undergraduate students. What we see is, one, I believe over time we have been able to increase the output of our programs to where we now have pre-licensure programs with 1,948 total student slots. Those are comprised, again, of students who are in the traditional program as well as the other programs that I spoke to. That second degree program just appears. It's only got a dot right now. It doesn't get a trend line yet. That appears for the first time in the 2019-2020 year. I'll anticipate a question about more current data. I'd make the point that the way we track this is we are looking at students first who graduate, and then we look for them taking their licensure exam within the first year after graduation. So a lot of our data has a built-in lag in terms of the current academic year. We won't see those students till they finish, and then till we move to the year after when we take the measurement. We have a large number of students who are interested in nursing, so the interest is there, and a large number of students who are qualified applicants. By being qualified, that is typically a result of an entrance exam that they take for nursing, as well as meeting target GPAs in order for our programs to continue to be successful. And success is really not about the program, it's measured by the student. We want to recruit people who are capable of completing the education, capable of completing their licensure exams, and actually having an opportunity to enter into the workforce. And so out of those numbers, we have about 1,922 students that were accepted in the 2019-2020 year. Could we do more? I'll just add a comment to this slide. The challenges we have are frankly on two ends of this process. You've probably heard this before, but one element of this is being able to recruit nurse educators. And so what we don't want to do is compromise the quality of our programs by diluting the student-faculty ratio in the programs. And on the backside is the availability for clinicals so that students can actually complete their education. So we are working with employers in the healthcare business, and I'll talk a little bit more about some of those opportunities, to develop better opportunities, more access to clinicals so that students have the opportunity to have that real-world experience as well as their classroom experience when they're going through the program. So our pre-licensure nursing program graduates has increased substantially over the past 10 years. An editorial comment I'll make, I guess I first became aware of the nursing challenges in Florida in 1978. So I'm dating myself, but I would just share, I think that this has been something that we have been probably working as hard as we can in the state to understand how do we get nurses in the pipeline. And we continue to do that. But I think we've found ways, and particularly some of these new approaches, not only in the classroom setting, but recently our board, in fact, last week received a presentation from the University of South Florida, who's doing some fairly innovative things to get students more quickly located in the nursing environment while they're actually students. They have what they call a preceptor program. They have several internship programs. We're also focusing on working with our employer partners on the types of quality of life aspects that any employee faces, but recognizing that this is a particularly difficult profession. Certainly been challenged like no other, or at least as much as any other, in the last couple of years. And so understanding not only what it takes to qualify someone to be a nurse, but also what it takes to retain them in the workforce. We are proud of our nursing graduation rate. In fact, our nurses have a higher four-year graduation rate than our average four-year rate. I think that is because of some of the focus that's been placed on the students themselves and helping them successfully complete a curriculum. I think it's also an area that where you tend to not recruit someone in who then doesn't choose to finish. That in other degrees, you change your mind, you get exposed to something different. I think the programs themselves sort of are given to being a very direct or linear mindset in terms of what your areas of study are going to be, what your classes are going to be. But I think it's also a testimony to the deans in our schools that they're focusing. If we graduate students sooner, then we're able to graduate more students over time, and that's one of the ways that we're able to address the shortfalls. Retention is an area that we are responsible for tracking. I would share that this is an area that we are continuing to work on. We've sort of created our own challenge. As I mentioned earlier, we have students coming in at different times. So the traditional way of tracking retention would be looking at a first time in college, or I still fight acronyms, but you may hear the term FTIC, first time in college students. So it's one thing when you look at a first time college student, which we measure retention in their second year. But as I said, we also have programs now where we're admitting students on an accelerated basis, sometimes getting someone with a second degree, sometimes getting someone coming into the program with some background in the military in other areas. So we're trying to think about the way that you put this together in a meaningful way and not just a slide, as I've got a couple of them, with a lot of different lines on it. How do you roll all this up? But this is an area, so measuring it's important, but focusing on it is equally important. And I would share with you that it is a strong area of focus. It's why we're trying to recruit the most qualified students in what are some limited number of slots, and why we want to work with those students to help them to be successful. Because when they're successful, then we're successful as we do this. I'm frankly very satisfied and proud of our exam passage rate. It is obvious that if you want to be a nurse, you not only have to graduate with either an RN or a BSN degree at a minimum, but you also have to be able to pass the licensure exam rate. And we not only look at this in the aggregate, but we also look at our graduates as they pass the exam whether they pass the exam on their first try, their second try, or later than their second try. And I believe that we have seen continued improvement and focus in our system on making sure that our students are not only qualified to graduate, but that they're also able to pass those licensure exams. And again, the sooner they are licensed, the sooner they are in the workforce. Back to House Bill 1507 for just a minute. We are working very closely in developing a survey mechanism that we have also been coordinating with Department of Health and the new nursing center that is located at the University of South Florida to develop a survey process where when nurses are, when they come back for their relicensure, we are able to ask a set of questions that will give us some information about whether they're still in the workforce, get some idea of where they are, as well as kind of areas of practice or areas of additional education. So other than just the data that is available to us in some context, we also want to get the feedback directly from the nurses themselves. I would share an area that is still somewhat of a challenge, and this is across workforce in general, but it's kind of one of my pet things to try to work our way through. Today, we still can't see, we can see in the aggregate that our graduates are employed, and we can see what they make, but we can't tell where they are. And so, for example, one of the things I think is important for our state is to understand which students are staying in the state of Florida and which students are going somewhere else. And if we know they're going somewhere else, I'd like to start then peeling that back to better understand and why. One of the things that we know from the discussions we've had, nursing is a very competitive business today. This new genre of traveling nurses pays multiples of what a nurse who is physically located in just one place can make. It's a tough job, I'm sure. And some of our board members actually are experts and leaders in the healthcare professions. And I've talked to some of them about just what their contract employee versus in-house employee bases are. It's a huge game, I'll use that word right now, for employers across the country to try to recruit nurses from somewhere else. And so what we want to do is look at what the potential responses are to that. I think it also brings us back to the part of some of the work that's being done through the Nursing Center at USF. Is understanding how do you build that employer-employee loyalty relationship? Are you being hired by a company that treats you, and this is sort of the context I think we're seeing across business. You know, when someone comes in, this early experience they get as an intern or somehow being involved in the actual practice of nursing before they graduate, where they can work with a trained nurse, helps them to understand what the job's really all about. how they're treated in terms of other benefits that are offered to them. It's kind of like the counseling I give to my own children. Don't just look at the salary. Look at the total package. Look at the history of the company. We're understanding that we have to build that into the conversations we have with our employers. We're working very closely with the healthcare providers in the state, but we also want to then measure this as we go through this survey process. Madam Chair, that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you so much. Looks like we have...
I did have another slide, but I don't know that it's going to add more to it. It's more background information. I apologize for that.
No worries. We do have a slew of questions, looks like. But first, I have a question for you. As it relates to the accelerated programs, when the slide that broke down the enrollment in each type of program, looked like there was around 1,000 traditional BSN first time in college, and then there was 500 or so in the accelerated. Can you provide some color behind the cost of building out those two different programs comparatively? Is there any difference in cost on that?
I think this is the slide you were asking the question about. It's not necessarily the cost. I can check with the universities to get more detailed information if there is. I think a lot of this is, in the case of the VCARE program, that's actually one that does receive some federal funding, so there's actual additional impetus to that. I think that the opportunity there is to understand that we need to be reaching out to individuals, not just those who started college thinking they wanted to go into nursing, but to really be thinking about how we attract other individuals who may have some related background and make it simpler for them to go through it. I would say from the perspective of the cost to the individual, what we're able to do is take advantage of the credit they've already. So, for example, in a second degree program, we're able to take advantage of the experience, the classic credits that they've already have, and think about how we build a degree on top of a degree rather than causing them to start back from scratch. I think the challenge in the area of a freshman admit, but it actually draws from experience we've had with some of the targeted pathways that we have with the college student, with the college system. You know, the idea that you can give someone from day one a goal and an outcome is helpful in retention and it's helpful in graduation success. I would actually say that there is some synergies in these things that allow us to really create a mindset for an individual and, frankly, a commitment on our side that if you know where you're going, it's an easier path sometimes than a typical path. Obviously, when someone graduates from high school and doesn't really know, you know, what that last day is, what degree they're going to have on the day they graduate. I'm sort of one of those back at a time when, you know, you didn't have to decide that till you were junior. And then the data point I still have is that 30% of our incoming freshmen change their major during orientation. But in this area, when you really have somebody, and I don't want to pick on accountants, and I'm not one, but, you know, somehow accountants kind of know they want to be accountants and they know what the pathway looks like. It's helpful if we can do that in other degree areas so that someone can really understand the straight line forward and then build around it rather than sometimes like my career path looks like some of these lines that are up there. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Fernandez-Barkin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, sir. So you touched on something very interesting in regards to the traveling nurses, and that is something that I've spoken with a lot of the local healthcare providers in my district, that is one of the reasons for the rising cost that they're facing, is that they're essentially dealing with the staffing agencies that are paying the nurses more, right? Do you have any idea how many of your graduates are going directly to these staffing agencies as opposed to staying in-house in these in healthcare institutions?
I am hopeful that we will. We have that same challenge and it's a longer conversation, but I have the same challenge that in across the gamut of our degrees, I can't see what state someone went to. much less start working my way through, so why did you go there? I believe if we could understand that, we could prioritize areas like this. I think we can do some work based sort of anecdotally on the conversations we're having with the healthcare providers in Florida, because they're doing the same thing. I also need to know, or we should know, I guess it's not me, it's not about me, but we should know what nurses are moving here because we're doing X, Y, or Z. I believe that we could also be very successful if we thought about how to retain students in our state, whatever that incentive needs to be, thinking about the student and maybe compared to sometimes the program, and thinking about what would cause someone to be more desirous of staying in Florida. Whatever those things would be, you know, because employers offer signing bonuses, for example.
Yes, and to answer your question, although it's not, as you said, there's no way to really track those travel agencies, they usually require, they have worked somewhere for a year before they can start traveling elsewhere. So I don't think there's any students going straight into travel nursing. Any other questions? Representative Andrade, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And along that same type of line of questioning, had two questions on the labor market specifically. The first is, since 2010, we've seen a decrease in the percent of qualified applicants being accepted into a nursing program in the state of Florida. Do we believe that we need to increase the number of slots to accept more qualified applicants into our programs to address that labor market demand?
You're recognized.
Madam Chair. I think the percent decrease is a result of the percent increase in the applicants themselves. My concerns are we need to try to think about how we solve one, how do we have more nurse educators so we maintain the quality of our programs, and we need to be able to increase the access to the clinicals, which is working with our employers, so that the nurses have the practical experience that's part of their education as well. An area that I try to resist is the idea, I don't want to recruit more people if we can't educate them well, and if we can't guarantee success, but we ought to give them a darn good chance of being able to get through the program in a reasonable period of time at a good cost so that they get into the workforce as quickly as possible.
Representative Bell, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chancellor, for being here to present this. The enrollment of nursing has increased 83% over the past 10 years, but which institutions have increased enrollment the most throughout the state of Florida?
I could get that for you. I'll be glad to do a follow-up. I don't have it in front of me right now. And I can say... Actually, I have a part of that, and I don't want to do it from my... If I just look at 2019-2020, the largest number of graduates came from the University of Central Florida with 351. FAU had 252, and the University of Florida had 215. Now, that's of that group. That's not a growth number, but that's saying that's where the three largest groups of nursing graduates came from in the last data year that I have.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Caruso, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chancellor. By the way, I am a CPA, and just to put that on record here.
I understand, sir, and I'm...
You indicated that nursing is a very competitive profession today, and it certainly is. And, you know, the metrics are indicating that 94% are passing the licensure exam. Over 90% are completing their education in a four-year period. And the metrics are tremendous. They're great. But do you think in these challenging times of COVID and our aging population that we might need to rethink the student-faculty ratios in order to, get more applicants into the nursing programs and eventually into the workforce to try to solve this shortage that we have? Are we stretching our resources enough?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I would say it's interesting to me because the natural tension that occurs if I'm at a university, I want to enroll as many students as I can. And then on the flip side, I want to maintain my education quality as best I can. And that's sort of the natural tension that we intentionally create for all of our graduates. We should not just be enrolling people in the hopes that we get enough of them through that we get a few more people out. We don't want to compromise the quality side of it as well. It has been interesting to me in the current time. I would have thought it would have become easier to attract someone in the nursing profession to become a nurse educator, particularly in the last couple of years. It's been a tough job in the workplace. And what we haven't really seen is, if anything, we've probably seen people leaving employment rather than thinking about pathways to do something else. That's one of the conversations we're having with the universities. Whether or not you could, you know, I think we're today the cap is, I believe, 18 to 1. What would you get if you move that? As long as we didn't see that we suddenly didn't have, we could also see we had fewer people successfully getting through and passing the licensure exams. It's a balancing act between quantity and quality. And I do appreciate, I like the fact that in our state, we've had a history for a while now of really putting tension on, it's great to recruit students, but you've got to retain them. You've got to graduate them. You've got to work with them to get into the workforce. If you don't do that, we haven't met the commitment we should be making to our state.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. You indicated that we had, and thank you for that answer, that we had 5,300 qualified applicants, and we accepted just over 1,900 of them. So we left 3,000 applicants, more than 3,000 applicants, you know, out there and outside of our nursing programs. And I'm just wondering, with a student-faculty ratio of 18 to 1 that you just mentioned, have we studied or had tests, programs where we might have raised that ratio to 24 to 1 and then see what our metrics are in terms of graduation rates and success in passing the licensure exams and things like that?
You're recognized.
Sure. I don't know. I don't have that information. I would share, though, the other part, and you'll hear from, I believe you're going to hear from some of the others after me. So if they don't get into our nursing school, we're not the last resort, nor are we the first resort necessarily, so that no one thinks I put them behind us. You're going to hear from the colleges. You're going to hear from private schools in the state. We have other pathways for people to go through a nursing education. I would also note that in the university system, you know, we are targeting, as is our mission, undergraduate degrees and above, and there are a lot of pathways for someone to go into nursing and into healthcare business through an RN, for example, degrees that don't require 4 years of study. We do what we do because we have employers who tell us that they also want individuals that have a BSN or higher, so we're trying to respond to what our employers are telling us.
Thank you. And we do have two more presentations. I'm going to go to Representative Andrade for a second bite at the apple, and then we're going to move on. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I'll just ask one short question then in the interest of time. Do we have information on which state university programs have the highest first-time licensure passage rates? And as a diehard Gator, please tell me why it isn't FSU.
You're recognized.
We do have individual data, and I'd be happy to provide that to the committee so that you all can see it. I would tell you that, I'll just say 9 of our programs are doing very well and have very high results. We have one program that is very intentionally working and actually was in front of my board last week talking about the work that they're doing to increase their licensure exam passage rates. So we don't have any universities that aren't working very hard to make sure that this is all the way through licensure and employment, not just getting a degree.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Appreciate it. I hope I don't blow up your computer.
All right. Next, we will have Chancellor Hevda. And Vice Chancellor Goodman, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Good morning.
Thanks for the extra minutes to get the slideshow up. We're pleased to be here today. I'm Kathy Hebda, the Chancellor of the Division of Florida Colleges in the Florida College System. And with me is Vice Chancellor Tara Goodman from the Division of Career and Adult Education. And we're pleased to be here to present to you today information from both the Florida College System sector, the School District Technical Center sector, and the sector of the institutions that are regulated by the Commission for Independent Education, which is the for-profit private institutions in Florida. Since Chancellor Kreiser talked a little bit about the background already and the types of studies we're doing, I'm going to skip through those and get to the portion where we're actually talking about the types of nursing programs that we're going to be looking at this morning in our institutions. Chancellor Kreiser focused on BSNs and graduate programs. That's what's offered in the university system. In this case, we have three types of programs that we're going to talk about today that are pre-licensure programs in our institutions. The first is the licensed practical nurse, or LPN, the RN, which is something you can apply for after you've completed your associate in science in nursing, and then a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, or a BSN. One quick note. Although the CIE institutions may offer BSNs similar to the state university systems that are pre-licensure, in the Florida College system, a BSN is really our typical 2+2 system, so the folks that are admitted to a BSN in the Florida College system already have their ASN, and so that data is not included as far as our admissions and completions for the Florida College system today. So this chart gives you an idea of the types of programs offered in the various sectors, whether it's LPN, ASN, or BSN. And you'll note a couple of things. School district career centers do not offer college credit courses, so they are focused on the LPN programs because those are clock hour programs, though they do articulate into associate in science degree programs that are offered by FCS institutions and independent institutions. And then you'll notice that the Florida College System institutions, all 28, now that Hillsborough Community College was finally approved last year, all 28 do offer a Bachelor of Science in Nursing degree. And all of us offer the Associate in Science in Nursing. I would say, just by way of context, the vast majority of the enrollment, I would say 2/3 of the enrollment in the Florida College System, is in the Associate in Science in Nursing program. About 1/3 of the enrollment is in the BSN, and we do have a few colleges that offer the LPN program. That's primarily offered by school districts, but based on geographic locations, sometimes the Florida College System is the local institution offering an LPN program. This just reviews the survey instrument. You've already seen this from Chancellor Kreiser. We're focused on the left-hand side of the page today, mostly on this is a data survey, so it's about applicants, eligible enrollments, and completions. So I'm going to break this down by sector. We'll do school district information, technical center information, Florida College System, and then CIE. And we do have, in case there are really in-depth questions from members about the CIE data, Jason Bowman is here with us in the audience in case additional questions need to be answered. So for school districts, new seats available for individuals who want to apply to be an LPN. You'll notice there was a decrease in the last couple of years, although it is certainly relatively stable over the last 10 years. When talking with institutions about that in school districts, they said primarily because you can see these are small programs and small numbers, both the effects of Hurricane Michael, because our data in this survey only goes through 1920, and COVID had impacts on faculty available to teach, as well as student enrollment the last 2 years. In the Florida college system, you'll see more stability in recent years, although it's definitely a significant increase from 2012-13 and forward. And I would also say that in the, as I said, this data only goes through 1920, but the Florida college system institutions in this past year have added quite a number of new slots, even including this current year that we're in now. Here's the comparative data for the independent institutions. When talking with them about the reasons for the dramatic increase over time of new slots, many of those institutions were not even in Florida in 2010-11. They're new institutions or newly approved programs within the last 10 years. So you can see many of those institutions have come recently to this work in Florida. Then for going to prospective nursing students, here's then where you get the comparison that certainly Chancellor Kreiser focused on in his last presentation. What's the difference between who applies, who's eligible, and who is actually admitted? So we'll go through all three sectors separately. I'll make a note on this slide, though, that really does also work for the Florida College System slide. And the number of applicants that apply, you can see there, certainly the word got out that we needed nurses and people started applying to be a nurse. At the same time, these applicants may have applied for a number of different institutions. So this is not an unduplicated number. An applicant may have applied for their local school district and also applied at a Florida College System institution. There certainly is a gap in the number of people who applied and who was accepted, but it is exactly this gap. It's hard for us to tell based on the survey data that we received. So there you see the same thing in the Florida College System, as I mentioned. Certainly people have been applying to be a nurse. This may be a duplicative number for some individuals who applied multiple places. The number of available slots, as you've seen, has arisen, people accepted. And the number of eligible applicants the last 3 years is pretty much the same, even though we've received a lot of new applications over time. Commission for Independent Education, this is very similar to the slide we saw earlier for new slots. Theirs has risen almost identically. Number of applicants were able to be accepted and able to be enrolled in those institutions. At this point, I'm going to turn it to Vice Chair Goodman, who's going to go through a different set of slides on completion and other data on performance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As you would expect, when you are looking at people coming into the system and being admitted, the track is going to continue in terms of graduation. And I think most of us are interested on both capacity as well as production and completion of students in these programs. And so you'll see here we're starting with the district nursing program graduates. They have decreased slightly over the last 10 years. We are consulting with the institutions who self-reported this information to identify what might be going on with this. Some of the initial things reported to us are they are having nurse educator problems. I think we heard from Chancellor Kreiser about the challenge of finding qualified faculty. And so some of them reported that. At least one institution in the Panhandle was adversely affected significantly by Hurricane Michael, and that contributed to the decline. So we are continuing to look at this information, and we'll continue to monitor the access for the licensed practical nursing programs, which is what the district technical colleges are able to offer. You'll see here very steady state in the Florida college system nursing program graduates. This is a combination of all graduates, is my understanding. This is the pre-licensure that includes LPN and the ADN programs. But the vast majority of these are the associate degrees. There's only a small percentage, less than 10% of graduates that appear to be coming from the licensed practical nurse side of it. I think that's driven largely by the profession. There's a large need for registered nursing. Licensed practical nurses cannot do the same tasks that registered nurses can, and many health providers may be preferring those individuals who can maximize their skill set. In the school district side of it, on the technical college, many of our graduates are interested in entering the associates in science degree program eventually as a pathway program, so they can get a credential, begin to earn work, and then move on to the bachelor's degree. Many of them do have that goal. You'll see here the track in the number of graduates has increased exponentially. As Chancellor Hebda indicated, access in our Commission for Independent Education Institutions has increased exponentially, and you see this in the number of graduates being produced out of this sector that were not being produced approximately 10 years ago. In terms of graduation rates, we see on average for the past 10 years a completion rate of 70.3% on the school district technical college side. Again, this is self-reported data. These are data points that we're going to be looking at as we try and improve access. Our institutions were asked to look at a point in time and give us data over the past 10 years. So we are continuing to analyze these numbers. For the Florida college system, they have averaged about 69% over the past 10 years. You will see a dip in 2019, which is not really a dip. This is just a nature of that we don't have enough, a long enough time series to see the completion of these students. We have students who are entering perhaps on a part-time basis initially, and so they have not had enough time in the time series to see the full completion rate associated with some of these cohorts. So that's why you see the numbers for the most recent years may be a little bit smaller than you would expect once you have a longer time series to track them. Similarly, the Commission for Independent Education Institutions, they have an average graduation, four-year graduation rate is reported by them of about 60%. And again, the latter part of this time series may indicate that you have students in part-time capacity who have not had time to fully complete the program. It's most likely not a real dip in performance, it's just a reflection of the time series that you're looking at. Then, of course, once a student completes a program, you in order to sit for the NCLEX practical nurse or the NCLEX RN exam, you will have to be a completer from an approved program. So that's a condition. You're not going to sit for one of these exams unless you have completed an approved program. The passage rate for districts on their NCLEX is 85.8%. I do need to verify whether or not this is first time I noticed that Chancellor Kreiser indicated that he had both first time and retest. I suspect it's first time, but if the committee is interested, we can certainly clarify that. And similarly for the Florida College System, they have a very steady rate, an average of 88.5% in their NCLEX passage rates over time. We do not have CIE data in this, this presentation. We do have their representative here. My understanding is the rates are quite similar in the 85 to 88% range, depending on the type of program. But if you need that information, we have that available. And I'll close with essentially the same next steps that Chancellor Kreiser reviewed. You know, we're continuing to work on the parts of this, these data that were required in the bill that we don't have complete access to. We want to evaluate all the self-reported institution data and improve upon that and create a common set of data definitions and refine our survey instruments to make sure that we are accurately collecting the information that's needed to evaluate where we are in meeting our supply and demand and how our programs are performing. And so we will, of course, continue to partner with the Board of Governors and the University of South Florida on these healthcare gap analysis so that we can complete that picture. That concludes our summary of our programs, and we're happy to address any questions.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I do have a question. Actually, touching on my similar question to the Board of Governors, what is there anything prohibiting or limiting the FCS's ability to offer accelerated BSN for second degree students?
Specifically, thank you, Madam Chair, the BSN degree. I don't know if there's necessarily a limit that's different for that than it is the other programs, although largely BSN doesn't involve as much clinical requirement as the ASN does. And I know a number of our BSN programs are actually fully online or have a fully online option. And so most of our folks that are taking their BSN are working as RNs right now. And their graduation, I think 150% is over 80% of them graduate within 150% of catalog time. So they're moving through much quicker than our typical lower division part-time students are.
Okay, and so for students that have a bachelor's degree unrelated that are now going back to go get a BSN, is there, you know, in the Board of Governors, they listed there about 500 of their students are doing that program. Is there anything that can be done to implement programs similar to that at the college level? I know the quality of your students is phenomenal and the quantity of your students is also phenomenal. And so just as an access point, is there any way to incorporate that in some of the programs that are being offered?
Thank you. That's something we can look into and provide more information on. We'll talk to a couple of institutions that do that. We are a machine when it comes to taking ASNs and giving them into the baccalaureate program. Same thing with LPNs and getting them their ASN. So having a returning baccalaureate student who has a bachelor's degree in something else would, I think, might be something different for us if they are already licensed. But I'll be happy to look into that and see.
Great. Thank you. Representative Mooney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question. So both presentations touched on faculty and decrease in faculty. Is there any data that shows, is that based on salary, or is there a feeling that they're just not enjoying the work? I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people leave jobs, but usually has to do with money more times than not. And I have a second question, if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair.
You're right.
Just to touch on, so I don't forget it. Is there any programs that allow for field experience to add credits to a program? For instance, you're 5 years as an EMT. So you obviously had a lot of practical experience on the ground in some very horrific situations more times than not. Do these any chance that there was any programs or thought of having that field experience apply to credits to move forward in the programs?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To address your first question, what we hear from institutions is that, and I think I specifically mentioned for school districts, the dip in their enrollment was categorized by both Hurricane Michael issues and faculty issues during COVID. In the Florida college system, what we hear mostly is there are retirements going on in the nursing faculty field, and then it's hard for them to compete for new faculty. So if we're talking about expanding programs and adding more slots, that is one of the things that's difficult for them to do, because you can make a lot more as a nurse on the floor than you can teaching, even though the credential might be higher to be a teacher with a master's level degree. So that's one of the things, and I think they do have partnerships now, though, with hospitals. They're working together more to share employed nurses who can then also teach part-time. There are accreditation, some other issues you might be careful of when you start to employ a lot of part-time faculty, but it is something that can help here and there. So the second question, remind me what the second question was.
Please.
Referencing field work.
Oh, the field EMT, work, yes, thank you. So specifically, we do have a process in the college system where you can look at experience and award credit for it. I would say primarily, though, for EMTs, there's already a pathway in most colleges to accept their coursework they did as an EMT and articulate that into college credit. So that's the primary pathway now, too.
Members, any other questions? Representative Andrade, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I was just curious, do we have data on CIE institution graduation rates, and are we able to compare those rates to FCA or other graduation rates in the state?
We do have it by, not here with me, but we can get that to you by institution, similar to what Chancellor Carzer was saying. We have the institution breakouts for you if you'd like them.
Representative Persons-Mollica for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chancellor and Vice Chancellor, for being here today. I wondered if one of you could provide any additional perspective regarding why we see such a difference in the increase in number of slots between the institutional education or institutional programs versus the district and Florida college system. Are there any constraints that the independent institutions don't face that the district and college system face, or are there any other reasons that are leading to this difference?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that going back to what we did learn from the CIE office, that a lot of the dramatic increase was just the adding of new schools. So some of that wasn't, some of it was expansion of programs, but some of it was just adding new schools in the mix in the last 10 years. So there aren't new Florida College System institutions and new school district technical centers. It's the same ones. And so I think probably a better comparison would be to look at those institutions that have been there for 10 years and how much were they able to expand compared to our institutions that have been here for 10 years. At the same time, we also do hear differences in resources that are available. Our tuition is still, for 30 semester hours, it's still $3,205 like it was 5 years ago for 30 semester hours. Private institutions may have different different types of tuition that they can charge. But I think it, those resources still in the college system, one of the things that I've noticed that we've done, Daytona State is one example that is top of mind. Just this year, as I mentioned, that our data in the survey only goes to 1920, but this year, Daytona State was able to add 180 new slots to their nursing program. They had a small appropriation last year, they got a grant award, but they really reprioritized what they were doing with their existing resources and were able to open more slots that way. And a number of institutions have done that. Central Florida State College has taken their gymnasium that they used to have for basketball. They got rid of some sports, very tough decision. And now the gymnasium is going to be completely used for health science training. Respiratory therapists, surgical techs, all of that. So there's a lot of things that are going on that with existing resources that are increasing nursing slots, and our graduation increases as well. We had 5,600 graduate this past year, which again is not on the survey.
Thank you. Representative Harding, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the shout out to Central Florida College. Go Patriots. Appreciate that. I have a question just in general. Could you give us some examples of conversations that are happening with the industry? Obviously, you know, with the shortage that we have, and obviously many of the questions that are asked are relating to that, but some of the, if you could give us some insight on some discussions maybe with the stakeholders, with the industry, with the both the hospital, the nursing homes, the home health, all the different agencies that these nurses will ultimately work for, and some of their feedback relating to the both the curriculum, the coursework, the process, the timeline, and could you give us some insight on some of those discussions?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you may have something to add to this too. Some of the things that we're hearing from the Florida colleges, we mentioned some of those earlier clinicals, working together better on how to make sure everybody has a spot. Recently, St. Petersburg College had a did a convening in their region of their institutions, USF, other local institutions, their hospitals all came together to talk about what could they do to help solve the nursing shortage. And clinicals was one of the things. They were had a tradition. I think somebody mentioned it earlier today, doing things the way you've always done them. But they had a tradition of doing clinicals in a 12-hour slot. And somebody asked, why are we doing that? And they said, I don't know. So now they're doing things at night, weekends, all kinds of times when they wouldn't have done them. It does mean the hospital and the college have to figure out how the supervising nurse is going to be there. So it's not just as easy as changing a time schedule. But those are the kinds of things they're working through. Also, I mentioned earlier sharing faculty, sharing employed nurses to be faculty or clinical supervisors, things like that. Those are some of the things they're talking about now, too. And also sharing space, simulation space, regular space. College has really beefed up their simulators. During COVID, we had the opportunity with the emergency order to relax the percentage of clinicals that had to be done face-to-face in the hospital setting and could be done by simulation. And so some of the colleges that had really high-tech, really exemplary simulation equipment and had the nurses to supervise were able to really make some folks be able to graduate sooner under that emergency order. And many of them certainly have used their emergency dollars from the federal government to buy better simulation equipment. So that still takes people and nurses to supervise folks in certain ways and make sure they're doing it, using that equipment properly. But those are some of the things that they're talking about.
Thank you. Vice Chair Mello, you recognized for a question?
Thank you, Chair Mariano. Thank you, Chancellor and Vice Chancellor. My question is in reference to slide 13. And would you please address why the number of district nursing program graduates has decreased over the past 10 years? And I have a two-part question as well, Madam Chair. And do you believe that these students are attending other institutions?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chancellor.
Thank you for the question. And I think the source of it starts with actually slide number 10, because your graduates are going to track your slots, and you start to see a decline in some of the slots that are available. When we surveyed the institutions, they reported a variety of reasons. We're analyzing them at the institution level to see how many are steady versus how many have declined. They are self-reporting clinical site access, faculty access as the primary reason, and then we had the one panhandle institution that was essentially closed for a period of time as a result of their facility being significantly damaged. So that, you know, wiped out one provider for a little while as they worked to build back. So those are the information we have to date, but as I've indicated, we're going to continue to look at it. So you'll see that it tracks over. When you look at graduates, you start to see issues in graduates. But again, we're always evaluating this data for the dips, because some of these dips, you're like, why did it dip down this year? So we're going back to the institutions and confirming the data as well.
All right, members, any other questions? Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Last but certainly not least, we have Bob Boyd and Dr. Elizabeth Winslow with the Independent Colleges and Universities of Florida. Thanks for your time today, and you are recognized.
Madam Chair, Mariano, committee members, good morning. Thanks for having us today. I'm Bob Boyd again. I'm the president of ICUF. And just to make it clear to everybody, who is ICUF? We are in a separate silo from the other independent schools, which are CIE, Commission for Independent Education. Some of those are for-profit and other type of schools. ICUF are the nonprofit, the four-year traditional institutions in Florida. We've got about 175,000 students around Florida. And you'll see on that first slide, we have 17 schools of nursing in Florida. We produce about, if you look at the public and the non-public production of nursing degrees in Florida, we produce about 25% of all the nurses in Florida, and more than half of the graduate nursing program. So that's where you get the faculty. But you'll see on that list there that there's small colleges like Florida College and Weber, up to large institutions like Nova and the University of Tampa and the University of Miami. So again, think of us in a different silo from the other independent schools. And what I'm going to report on today is what these schools produce with regard to nursing degrees. We were included in the House Bill 1507 mandated nursing survey. All 17 of our schools responded to the survey. So we've got comprehensive data, and we have 100% response rate. I do want to thank the Board of Governors, Chancellor Kreiser, and the state college system, Chancellor Hebda, for working with us on the survey. They helped us create our survey and shared their data with us. So I wanted to thank them for that. If you go to the next slide, just at a glance, this sector is not the LPN sector. Our sector, we produce associates and bachelor degrees in nursing, ASN and BSN. We also have many RN to BSN programs for folks that are already a nurse. These are transitional programs. And then we, of course, have master's and doctoral programs. When you look at all the degrees offered in 2019-20, we produced 3,600 nursing degrees in 1920. The other thing I wanted to point out was we have 17 schools of nursing, but we have 44 unique education programs at different locations. And the Board of Nursing, they recognize each individual location, and we have to report on every location. So really, it's a little bit more complicated for us because we have 44 as opposed to just 17 and then 10 for the Board of Governors. On those branch campuses, we have associate and bachelor degrees and traditional and accelerated programs. You go to the next slide. Now, so let's talk about enrollment. This is enrollment data. So if you look at 2011, that was the group, the cohort that was supposed to graduate that year. And then so the 2020 cohort is 4,355. So you can see that has increased over time. One thing the chair did ask me to do, and it's not on this PowerPoint, and we will supplement the data and give you it in writing, but she did ask about applications, qualified applicants, and students accepted. And we do have that data, and I'll just tell you what it is. So for 2019-2020, the ICUF nursing programs received 9,247 applications. 4,893 were qualified, so that's 52% were qualified. Of that 52%, of those that were qualified, we accepted 82.7%, or 4,047. So that's a pretty good percentage and a high number of the acceptance rate for qualified applicants. And again, we will supplement that information to you after this meeting. The next slide is our retention rates. And we heard presentations from the other sectors about retention rates. So the students that started in 2010, the retention rate, basically it's starting and enrolled the following year. That's how we're tracking retention rates, and I believe how the other sectors have. So you'll see that it's 88% for students that started in 2019, which is a very good retention rate. It did dip a little bit, and I'll talk a little bit later in the PowerPoint about the COVID impacts and some of the impacts, but it's a good retention rate for our sector. With regard to graduates, the graduates went up from 2,064 to 3,053 over this 10-year period. And again, it's not on here, but the chair asked me to calculate graduation rate, and we do have that. The most recent graduation rate for nursing education programs, so this is the 2020 expected graduation cohort. And again, you heard Chancellor Kreiser talk about why there's a little bit of a lag time, but for 2020, our graduation rate was 70.1%. Now, what I do want to say is the year before, it was 84.5%. It went down, and I think there's COVID impacts and some other impacts, and again, I'll discuss that in a later slide. But our graduation rate in 2020 was 70.1%, and in 2019, 84.5%. With regard to the NCLEX exam, you'll see that our passage rate is 89.7%. We're proud of that rate. I believe the national average for the first-time test takers is 83.75%, so we're above the national average. The chair did ask us about first-time test takers, second time and third time, and we do have that data. So we had an 89.7% on the first try, 9.6% for the second-time test takers, and 0.9% for the third, which equals 100% of those that passed the NCLEX exam. And just for information, for 1920, that totaled 1,469 students that passed. Now, I mentioned on the next slide a couple things about COVID impact, and the institutions are telling me they, just like in every other area of study, we've had delayed student progress due to the challenges of COVID, the financial challenges. One of the issues, of course, and we've heard this, is the availability of clinical rotations. So that may account for some of the dip, but it is only a dip in our data. We have challenges beyond what the other sectors had to collect because we have so many challenges and unique programs in the independent sector. We have varying start dates, we have varying entry points, we have varying lengths of programs. So it's a little bit different than the more a general program in the public sector because of the differences of our institutions. Many that do, you know, handle these programs differently. I will tell you that on January 26, we presented nursing shortage recommendations to the Senate Healthcare HHS Appropriations Committee. We gave 17 recommendations on how to alleviate the nursing shortage. We boiled it down to top five priorities. We're happy to share with this committee those recommendations, but we are in talks with the Senate and hopefully with the House about how to address the nursing shortage in Florida. Madam Chair, that's our presentation. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. I have a question for you. You alluded to the number, I think you said 24% of all nursing degrees come from ICUF institutions. Mm-hmm. Where does that data come from? You could elaborate on that.
That's the IPEDS data, and that data is what year? That's 1920 data. So that's pulled right from IPEDS, which has a lag time. So that's associate through doctoral programs.
Okay. Thank you. And of the 3,600 degrees awarded in 2019-2020, do you have that broken down by degree level, undergraduate, graduate, et cetera?
We do. Okay, yeah, the data on the slide is only pre-licensure, but we can get you that data. That's something that we have that we can provide.
Great. Representative Bell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd asked the question earlier to Chancellor Kreisman, but which universities have increased the most of their enrollment?
Yeah, of our institutions, I would say maybe Kaiser and Nova have increased the enrollment the most. I would like to ask President Armstrong to come up because I think he testified earlier on the wrong bill. He was testifying on your PCB, but he wanted to make a comment on how they're expanding their nursing program at St. Thomas in Miami. I just like him to make the comment again, if you could.
Great, thank you. Just make sure you fill out another appearance card, please.
I will do that. Sorry we had it wrong the first time. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. 3 points, growth. The question has been asked by you, Madam Chair, can we grow? We started out with 13 nurses 5 years ago. We now have 882, almost 900 nurses. We believe we can double that, but we need the resources. We need a whole new science building. So the need is there. And we believe that we can fill that. Secondly, someone asked the great question earlier. In order to increase our nursing students, you have to have more doctorates of nursing. And so we have started a DNP program, a Doctor of Nursing program, in order to produce more doctorates so that we can then educate more students. And lastly, I'll say this, is access. 80% of the students at St. Thomas University are minority. 100% of those students receive some type of financial aid from the university, and 70% of our students are Pell eligible. And in nursing, our students are actually 83% minority, and whereas in our undergraduate and our university, a majority of our students of minority are Hispanic, in nursing, the majority of our students, those 83%, are African American and Haitian. And when they graduate, 100% of those students are staying local and serving in underserved areas.
Thank you. Representative Harding, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got two questions. The first question is on tuition. Could we just talk about the tuition comparability of both from the independent colleges compared to the cost of the public colleges?
You're recognized.
I can get you the tuition of each institution. Again, since we're independent, there's not a set tuition. It's different across the sectors. It's going to be more expensive because obviously we have to operate based on the true cost of tuition. But for example, one of our recommendations to the Senate was, and President Armstrong talked about access, is to increase EES for nursing students. So when you put together EES and Bright Futures and need-based aid, it does really make those institutions affordable. But again, it's the true cost of tuition versus the state tuition, which is subsidized, and that's why you have the radical difference.
Follow-up, you're recognized.
Yep. Thank you, Chair. And I also just want to take a moment to congratulate you on the passing rate and also your enrollment increases over the past several years. It is very impressive. I want to ask you the same question I asked earlier, and that is, obviously, you just alluded to it, you know, obviously you represent a lot of different colleges, but the question I have is, could you give some examples of where schools are actively engaging the job providers, the people that these nurses are ultimately going to work for, and some examples of how you've engaged that private sector, both the hospitals, the nursing home, the home health agencies, and other healthcare providers and how you brought them in and determining your coursework?
I'll probably give you the best example. So Advent Health University is in Orlando, right next door to Advent Health Hospital. And that's why Advent Health University was developed. And every one of their nursing students has clinical rotations across the street at the hospital. So we've engaged with the private sector and tried to foster those partnerships. When we did our nursing recommendations to the Senate, we included the hospital system with us in our recommendations. So that's something, I mean, I can't speak at every institution. You probably have the same type of partnerships in Miami. But that's something that you know, that's frankly an area where we excel, because we have the ability to adapt and evolve quickly with the private sector.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Caruso, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for presentation. And your statistics are outstanding, as across the board with the other presentations. I was wondering, what is your average student faculty ratio throughout the independent colleges?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard from the state there was an 18-to-1 cap. It's going to be different with each independent institution because they are independent. St. Thomas's is 14-to-1, and I think a lot of students pick our sector because of small class size and want to take advantage of that. But that doesn't mean we can't expand what we have and do it quickly.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right, and one final question for you. On slides 4 and 5, it says pre-professional, and then on slide 6, it says pre-licensure. Can you explain if there's a difference between those two?
There's not. It's just the same description using different terms.
All right. Any other questions, members? Nope. Well, thank you so much
for your presentation.
Thank you to all of our presenters for giving us the data we need. And it's been a very productive meeting today. Thank you all for your participation. And with that, Representative Mooney moves we adjourn.